Coltrane with Dahomey Dance. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Monday, January the 14th, and French fighter jets began pounding Islamist rebel strongholds deep in northern Mali yesterday as Paris poured out more troops into the capital, Bamako, awaiting a West African force to dislodge Al-Qaeda-linked insurgents from the country's north. But today, a town in central Mali has fallen to the Islamist insurgents, and their leaders were promising reprisals against France for its intervention. More than two decades of peaceful elections had earned Mali a reputation as a bulwark of democracy, but that image unraveled in a matter of weeks after a military coup last March that left a power vacuum for the Islamist rebellion. France convened a UN Security Council meeting today to discuss the situation on the ground. French President François Hollande has decided that he would encourage some 30,000 French expatriates to be extra careful, those living in neighboring and mostly Muslim states. Concerned about the reprisals, France has tightened security at public buildings and on public and on public transportation. It advised 6,000 citizens to leave Mali today. As Vice President Joe Biden finalizes a package of recommendations for the president to curb gun violence, the National Rifle Association is predicting that Congress is likely to block any new laws that would ban assault weapons. The NRA has so far prevented passage of another assault weapons ban like the one that expired in 2004. The organization spent some $24 million in the 2012 elections, $16.8 million through its Political Action Committee, and nearly $7.5 million through its affiliated Institute for Legislative Action. Separately, the NRA spent $4.4 million through July the 1st to lobby Congress. Meanwhile, in the 4 years since President Obama took office, an estimated 67 million firearms have been purchased in the United States. That's more than were sold in almost 7 years before his first election. December 2012 saw a record-shattering number of requests for criminal background checks on prospective gun buyers. Local gun dealers say the year-end surge has continued right into 2013, with demand far outstripping supply. Sandy Jackson, the wife of former Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr., announced on Friday that she'll be resigning her seat in the City Council in Chicago effective tomorrow. The reason, she says, is that she has to deal with, quote, very painful matters, unquote. Alderman Jackson, whose husband recently resigned from Congress while being treated for bipolar disorder and other medical issues, said in a letter to Mayor Rahm Emanuel that her resignation comes at a particularly hurtful time. Her husband announced his resignation, as you remember, back in November, shortly after winning re-election, citing his health concerns, but also acknowledging that he was under federal investigation. But Alderman Jackson reportedly also is a target of the same federal investigation. Sandy Jackson has worked with the Democratic Party for nearly two decades, including as the Democratic National Committee's Deputy Director of Training. She also worked for Bill Clinton's and Michael Dukakis's presidential campaigns. New York City is bracing for a strike by school bus drivers that would leave the parents of about 152,000 public and private students scrambling to get their kids to school. Local 1181 of the Amalgamated Transit Union, which represents about 9,000 bus drivers, is expected to take a strike vote any minute now over the Education Department's decision to accept competitive bids for transporting 22,500 special needs children who require special services. The contracts would cover 1,100 bus routes, about one-sixth of the city's total. The independent contracts do not require that veteran bus drivers be given preference as new hires, nor salaries at the same rate of pay. The protections were put into effect in 1979 after a 13-week walkout. There have been no strikes since. Mayor Bloomberg says that the city, exhausted from trying to cope with the after effects of Hurricane Sandy, does not have the money to meet the bus drivers' demands. And of course, the major piece of news yesterday was Colin Powell upbraiding his own party. He says that his party has been harboring a dark vein of intolerance, and it has to take a very hard look at itself. Here's what he said yesterday on Meet the
Press. On what basis are you still a Republican? Do you feel like the party has left you, or have you left it?
I think the Republican Party right now is having an identity problem. And I'm still a Republican. I'm a Republican who grew up along with George Bush, 41. I grew up with Ronald Reagan, Cap Weinberger, Frank Carlucci, that Republican Party, the Republican Party of Dick Lugar and John Tower. But in recent years, there's been a significant shift to the right, and we have seen what that shift has produced, two losing presidential campaigns. I think what the Republican Party needs to do now is take a very hard look at itself and understand that the country has changed. The country is changing demographically. And if the Republican Party does not change along with that demographic, they're going to be in trouble. And so when we see that in one more generation, the minorities of America, African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans will be the majority of the country, you can't go around saying we don't want to have a solid immigration policy. We're going to dismiss the 47%. We are going to make it hard for these minorities to vote, as they did in the last election. What did that produce? The court struck most of that down. Most importantly, it caused people to turn out and stand in line because these Republicans are trying to keep us from voting. There's also a dark vein of intolerance in some parts of the party. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is they still sort of look down on minorities. How can I evidence that? When I see a former governor say that the president is shucking and jiving, that's a racial era slave term. When I see another former governor after the president's first debate where he didn't do very well, says that the president was lazy. He didn't say he was slow, he was tired, he didn't do well. He said he was lazy. Now, it may not mean anything to most Americans, but to those of us who are African Americans, the second word is shiftless, and then there's a third word that goes along with it. Birther, the whole birther movement. Why do senior Republican leaders tolerate this kind of discussion within the party? I think the party has to take a look at itself. It has to take a look at its responsibilities for health care. It has to take a look at immigration. It has to take a look at those less fortunate than us. The party has gathered unto itself a reputation that it is the party of the rich. It is the party of lower taxes. But there are a lot of people who are lower down the food chain, the economic chain, who are also paying lots of taxes relative to their income. And they need help. We need more education work being done in this country. We need a solid immigration policy. We have to look at climate change. There are a lot of things that the American people are expecting. And the Republican Party, as they get ready for the next election, really has to focus on some of these issues and not ignore them. Everybody wants to talk about who's going to be the candidate. You better think first about what's the party you're actually going to represent. If it's just going to represent the far right wing of the political spectrum, I think the party is in difficulty. I'm a moderate, but I'm still a Republican. That's how I was raised. And until I voted for Mr. Obama twice, I voted for seven straight Republican presidents.
That was former Secretary of State Colin Powell talking about the challenges confronting the Republican Party. But it is significant, his comments are significant in the larger context. What he's saying is that the Republican Party itself is having a moment. If it chooses to use this time to look at itself and to see where and how it will adjust to the realities of the day, then it has a future and a future of relevance to the larger American public, as opposed to the internal needs of the egomaniacal folks on the inside. If it chooses to address the realities outside of itself, then it has a shot of being relevant in the political arena. If it chooses not to, then it therefore will be discarded. But in a way, what he's talking about with the Republican Party applies to the Democratic Party as well. This past election was a watershed moment for politics, period, irrespective of party. Well, of course, we are talking here about the Republican Party or the Democratic Party because, you know, that's basically our reality, our political reality. You can get X number of types of cars to buy or X number of flavors of Baskin-Robbins ice cream. But politically, the thinking is you can't handle more than two parties. So we have the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. And any other party coming into being has an uphill climb because the cards are stacked against it. The odds are against them having a successful time of it. But now is the time, this is a precise moment that any third party or any other than the two parties should be visibly organizing for the future. Why? The time is right. People are fed up. They've had it with the two-party system, and whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans blaming each other, they are disgusted with them both. The political machinery has ground to a halt. And people in this last election have finally seen the lack of ideas. They've run out of just about everything. They've run out of integrity. They've run out of credibility. They've run out of accountability, even good ideas. There's nothing really new that they're proposing that makes it an attractive thing for people to, you know, sit up and take notice. People have had it. Government is literally on their backs, and they're feeling it. We're feeling it in ways that we didn't before. So this means that this is a time for a party that has a good idea to come to the fore and to begin the process of organizing. Not in secret, to be very visible about it. This was a major criticism I had of the Green Party. The Green Party was not in the community, and yet it expected that people would support it. Why? The Green Party is not talking about the real issues affecting people in the community. How do you get to know these issues? You don't presume because you define the issues that everybody defines the issues in the same way. You go out to the community and you ask, what's going on? What is the most important thing to you? What are your priorities? And this is a time for specific communities of interest to be formed. Because that, after all, is what many of the third parties are. I don't necessarily think it's a good formula, because you have to be bigger and broader than just one single interest. But since it is the case that most people would tend, in the political sense, you would tend, the basis on which you feel disaffected or disfranchised or locked out would be the basis on which you organize. So it is possible that people would seize on a particular thing to organize a party around it. This is the time to mount a credible counteroffensive and to become very, very involved in communities in which you expect to do some good political work. This is the time. But already we're seeing that sense of, well, you know, the election is over. We need some time to recoup and relax a little bit before we mount another effort. And that would be dictated again by the political season. If you're truly disfranchised, if you truly want to make a change, you don't have time to sit down to catch your breath. You have to be out there absolutely, you know, visible in communities. And you start the process of cultivating a presence and cultivating a relationship with the community. I believe, for example, in the city of New York and other cities where I'm using the city of New York as an example, it is perfectly doable to target certain seats in the city council. It is perfectly feasible in other constituencies to target seats, maybe at the congressional level or at the state assembly or state senate. Target the seats, get these guys out, and put your folks in. This is the time to not let up. Because we see, for example, with the NRA, they're not letting up. And look at what is happening. They, in a way, they are really controlling the tempo of this debate on gun control. No matter what is said, no matter what the Democrats or the president or Joe Biden says, the NRA is the authority that has to be pleased. The NRA is not going to allow a decision to be made that, in their view, is counter to their position. But most importantly, the NRA funds its position. Now, people have some ideas about lobbying and they think that it's a really nasty thing. Okay, I agree in many ways, yes. But at some point, you have to decide whether you're going to play this game. The game is to arrive at a point of critical mass. By that I mean you build your constituency so that you become a force to be reckoned with. In all this time that these various constituencies have been voting for the Democratic Party, whether it's the gay community, or African Americans, Latinos, Asians, women, young people, whatever fragment of the constituency, the Democratic electorate you want to tackle, for all the investment that they've made, you still see the fact that they're not able to impress this party to carry through with the planks of its platform pertaining to their interests. Right now, The Obama administration, in effect, is responding to an agenda that is not really what their number one agenda should have been. They said the number one agenda is jobs. President Obama said the number one agenda is jobs. And I've discussed here before, it is not just that unemployment is just at 7.7 or 7.8% and is causing a crisis in America. You don't want to discuss the unemployment rate in the African-American and Latino communities. And you certainly don't want to discuss the unemployment rate for younger people. Now, this actually constitutes a huge crisis. And still, the constituencies aren't able to persuade the Obama administration to stay on course. This is not the second term. This is the fifth year. This is the fifth year in which we are not seeing the administration putting at front and center the number one issue for African Americans, Latinos, and other groups that supported this president and supported this party. The number one issue is jobs. Instead, they're now fighting with the gun control. They're now talking about debt ceiling and all of that stuff. And now, even so, the president is willing, his own party is urging him to say, listen, don't get sidelined by the Republicans on this debt ceiling business. Move around them. Because we know the fact of it. The fact of it is that the economy is the number one issue. The economy gets going when you have the job sector functioning healthily. Every economist knows that. But Barack Obama is following exactly the same thing that Clinton did. When Alan Greenspan said, well, the number one thing is that you've got to cut spending. And so he did. And he cut spending by gouging many of the social programs that the poor people were waiting on and the poor people depended on. In his news conference today, Barack Obama actually said the word poverty twice, but his focus is on the, quote, middle class, whatever that is. I don't know what the middle class is or what people mean by the middle class. But it doesn't seem to be those constituencies that are doing an awful lot of hurting. This administration should be focused on jobs, generating jobs. That's what they said they were going to do. And already, this is not the first year. This is year number five. Congress got absolutely nothing done and was successful in stymieing progress. And the Democratic Party did not do a thing about it, couldn't do a thing about it. So this is a time when political alternatives should be constructed. There should be planning all over the cities of America, that every city should have two or three or four other alternatives than the Democratic Party. In fact, I had maintained that if the one thing that African Americans should absolutely do is leave the party. Get out of it. This business of continuing to support your own annihilation, your own decimation, your own lack of progress is mind-boggling to me. Get out, leave the party, vote for anything else, but don't go for the Democratic Party because they predict that that's exactly what you would do. And once you lend the vote, you cast your vote for the party, you ignore. You're yesterday's news. This is the time for people to come together in their communities, decide what it is that they can organize around or organize with, and begin to become politically involved. Put some teeth behind your vote and make plans to move away from the Republicans and the Democrats. They have shown that they have run their course. Enough already. There's nothing else there. And if there is, it ain't going to be good. It's not going to support you. It's not going to be in your interest to stay. The party is out. The parties are out of ideas. Now, when it comes to the business of politics, I know, for example, in the African-American community, there's a lot of emotion associated with it. Well, you know, we fought so hard to get the vote. Exactly. You fought hard to get the vote, so why are you throwing it away? If you truly respect the value of your vote, you will safeguard it and you will honor it by doing some very serious work in constructing a political vehicle that places the value of the vote as your primary objective. You're voting for something. That's important. So I am hoping that we would see, because I'm going to be asking these parties, what is it that they're doing? We had a group, I forgot the name of the party that they did, or the movement that they founded in this last election. Some young guys who inherited a lot of money, and they started funding alternative candidates out of Washington, D.C. But we don't have enough of a groundswell for an alternative political system. Despite the fact that the one that we have, we know, is not working. So if we don't get energized about it, nobody wants to hear the complaints the next time elections roll around, and they're complaining about what they're not doing, and that they're not doing this and they're not doing that. Look, that's par for the course. We know that that's the way it works. Most everybody who has voted for Barack Obama is now saying things like, well, gee, you know, I hoped that, you know, we would have had this and we would have had that. Well, you're not in a position to affect his decision. There is no organization in the African-American community, in the Latino community. We just had Ruben Navarrete talking about that. That in the entire Hispanic caucus, he could name only one legislator who actually stood for something and who actually was functioning as a true advocate for the entire national Latino community. It's exactly the same in the African-American community. We have no way of forcing our votes to have the leverage that they ought to have post-election. We have no way of commanding Barack Obama to do anything, or the party as a party to do anything. So, again, this is the time. If you have some kind of membership or association with other parties, this is the time for you to communicate the message that they've got to start acting now and acting visibly. Don't hide. Let people see that you're out there. Come out to the communities. Ascertain what the needs are. And be visibly involved. because this two-party system has really run its course. There's no benefit to thinking that it would somehow miraculously change. As I said, this is not just Barack Obama's second term. This is his fifth year in office. Can you afford to wait to see how it happens? To wait to see what happens next? I don't think so. We'll take this break and come back to your questions and comments right after this. 1-888-874-4888. This is Lead Stories. I'm Beatrice Lead, and you are listening to PRN.FM. You know, I want you to encourage other people to listen to PRN.FM, and we are going to conduct a campaign on this program. Every program, I believe, would be doing exactly the same thing. We've got to get our voices heard, and that means I'm going to enlist every person listening to this program, my program, to be part of an outreach machine. Get at least, each person contact at least 5 or 10 people, you know, and let them know that they should tune in and get to know PRN, not just this program, but all the programs on PRN. And there's much diversity here. Speaking of diversity, I just wanted to do this little sidebar. You know, today, as President Obama was holding his news conference, you know, there was this reporter who asked a question about the diversity of his cabinet. It seems people are very, very concerned about the diversity of Barack Obama's next cabinet. And it's interesting, except, you know, I watched it also on the weekend news programs. You know, people are concerned about the diversity. It's a big topic this weekend, the diversity of Barack Obama's cabinet. And I said, you know, well, here's a joke. I want to see diversity in the newsrooms. When the newsrooms practice diversity, then they'd be in a position to demand to know about the diversity of the president's cabinet. When you take a look at America's newsrooms, no matter whether it's print or electronic, television or whatever, magazines or whatever you have as media, diversity is not one of the things that they have. The newsrooms of America remain exactly the way they were in the 1960s, when the Kerner Commission, studying the social tumult of the 60s, commented that the media actually contributed to a racially divided America, one white, one black, separate and unequal. So I would love CNN or Fox News or some other, New York Times or Newsweek or any one of the major media outlets to hold Barack Obama accountable for his supposed lack of diversity. And it really isn't, you know, when you see how it breaks out, but he's pretty okay on point on that score. But for the newsrooms to assume that they have some kind of moral authority to call diversity into question is the biggest joke going. 1-888-874-4888 is the number. Give me a call. So, yes, we are going to have this. I want you to write me at leadstories@gmail.com, and let me know that you are an ambassador for not just this program, but for this very valuable outlet, PRN.FM. I want us to grow this network exponentially. We got to do it. So if you're with me, I will know because you will send me a note saying, I've already told my folks, and I have at least 5 more people or 10 more people who are aware of lead stories and aware of PRN.FM. This is a very aggressive program that we're going to do, and there's no point in being coy about it. We have to grow the audience, and we grow the audience because we want people to know that there's an alternative to that crazy medium out there, the media world out there. There is an alternative point of view, and it is a wide-ranging point of view. Subject matters to please every single interest, from health to politics to economy to all kinds of things. So please let us grow this audience and make it a point. There's no point in pretending. It's just like the Green Party, they're acting like they didn't want to win. We want to win. So we win by increasing our audience. So do help in that effort and become an ambassador, especially for this program, but of course for PRN.FM. Okay. Let's see. Do we have anybody on the line yet? No, we don't. So what I want to do is, again, we're going to talk about the importance tomorrow. A very, very important show, and I want you to tune in because it's going to be very instructive. It really will be an extraordinary time that we will spend together tomorrow. So I want you to pass the word and ask people to listen in, and we'll all learn something. And then on Wednesday, we will have we'll try our second edition of debating. And we will tell you what the subject matter will be tomorrow so that you will be prepared for it. And that is where you are paired with someone and you are to debate. And there are certain things that you want to do. You want to pay attention to what the person is saying, listen very hard to what is being said, and you want to identify areas of weakness in the argument and strengths in your argument. So it's about encouraging debate and discussion. That's what we have to do. So tomorrow, very important that you tune in and very important that you encourage others to tune in. And on Wednesday, our debate. You will know the question tomorrow. Orville from New York. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice. I wanted to listen and hear the quality of your interaction with the audience, but I was going to sit and listen. But since no one was there,
it's for Wednesday. We're doing Wednesday is our debate day.
Mm-hmm. I, in terms of your topic and in terms of the political parties, I'm wondering that it is important, and I believe you're right on. I've been with you before. I've heard you say that. But when I'm looking at the individuals, the people, we the people, mm-hmm. and I'm looking at Latinos and other people of color, black folks, and their inability or unwillingness to critically think on their own behalf, that when we move, the rest of the country always moves. And if we're concerned about the country, we have to be concerned about ourselves. And the third parties, I remember speaking to someone on my Facebook page, and she came on and she wanted me to really push a third party. And at that particular time, I was not really pushing anyone. I never put anything regarding Obama or anyone on my page. I thought Obama should have gotten it, just because it would have been demoralizing for the country and for the populace if he didn't. But having said that, just like you're saying, it's the fifth term. There is no excuse for not creating an agenda that should have been there already and putting it to him. I think it was a waste, personally, to have actually look to Obama to do anything, because as you said, we have no base in order to even present anything to the man, much less demand.
Well, you know, there was a merit in being pretty hard on Obama, and I don't mean it in the cruel sense. You know, I'll tell you why. Even some of my own friends are very upset because I seem to be very critical of him. But I said this. When you are critical, it's not that you're trying to be difficult or ornery. You are responding to his lack of attention to what are very pressing priorities. And when these priorities are articulated, it holds him accountable and it holds you accountable. It's like a union shop. You know, a contract holds management accountable and workers accountable. It's the same thing. We have seen a systemic failure. The process failed and the people in the process are failing. Their process does not allow them to truly be advocates. Because when they are advocates, they get punished. You know, and the punishment could be very severe in there. But when they're operating in isolation and the system sees that they are operating in isolation, then they're disregarded. If you elect somebody and the system sees, whether, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, your constituency is constantly responding to you, then they are very careful about how they tread on our representatives, which is, I go back to Adam Clayton Powell.
Yeah.
Adam Clayton Powell's connection with his constituency was undeniable.
Yes.
And because he had such a strong connection with his constituency, they did not, I mean, they were going to mess with him a lot more, put it that way, but they had to watch their case with him because they knew that he was very much tied into his constituency. So that built a kind of buffer for him to be, as he used the word, audacious power. You know, that's what he exercised.
And swagger.
So that is what is helpful. When we hold our elected officials accountable, it's not just about criticizing them. It is also signaling to the power structure that they operate in that you are going also, you know, you're keeping ties with your representative, but you're also going to go to bat for them as well. So, you know, you tread on the ground very carefully if you're going to mess with our representatives. It's a form of protection for them. Now, if Barack Obama had from the African-American community an extraordinarily loud protest about the way things are going.
And I think he actually asked for that. If you actually listen, at least I heard it, when you listen to some of his speeches, where he says, you know, you're going to have to make me.
Mm. Well, yes, it does. It is exactly the point that it gives him greater leverage to say, this is what my folks want. And they're serious about it. I got to perform. So that's what I mean. We elect and then we retreat.
Yes.
And then we complain. So this is the time to be very forceful. Thanks a lot, Orville.
Before I leave, I would say to
you. Oh, what happened there? Oh, it's gone. Frank from New York, you're on the air.
Good morning, Latrice. My name is Frank, and I'm from New York.
Hello.
I have a quick question for you. I listen to your show every day, and I think it is absolutely wonderful and enlightening.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your show talks about the government and the money it loans to the large company that it takes from our tax dollars, like, for instance, AIG. Mm-hmm. When it takes this money and it gives to AIG, and AIG pays its money back, where does that money go after it pays it back?
I'm assuming that it goes into the Treasury. I have no idea where that money goes. Once you're talking about the fines that are levied. Well,
right. Who
of course,
that money?
It, The fines levied against AIG, of course, were the result of the lawsuit brought by the Justice Department. Right. But it would be very, you know, something I should take a look at that. I don't know where the money goes. I'm just thinking that it would be the Treasury.
Because I don't see that money coming back to us at all.
I don't see it either. But it would be a very interesting question to ask. I should ask that. Where does that money go? All these multi-billions, billion-dollar fines that we seem to be right. getting these days, where are we getting that? Where does the money go? It's like, you know, when we were told that the lottery was going to be funding education. Really? Has it happened? I don't think so. Thank you, Frank. So that's Music Signals, that it's time for me to say goodbye. We are going to meet each other again tomorrow. Tell at least 10 people. Let's grow this audience and, you know, put PRN on the map. That's what we've got to do. Thank you so much. Coming up next is Richard Martin with Wake Up Call. You want to stay tuned for that, and we'll meet each other again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Thank you. Bye-bye.